This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. 25 years ago, in order to be included among the Forbes 400, you needed to be a millionaire, a multimillionaire. You needed $75 million. Today, you need to have more than $1 billion. Here's how the Forbes special report on the 2007 Forbes 400 begins. $1 billion is no longer enough. The price of admission to this, the 25th anniversary edition of the Forbes 400, is $1.3 billion, up $300 million from last year. The collective net worth of the nation's mightiest plutocrats rose $290 billion to $1.54 trillion. This afternoon, we're going to take a look at how such wealth is accumulated, and how the very rich spend and sometimes lose their money. We'll also talk about what makes the very wealthy successful. Our guests are journalists Peter Bernstein and Annalyn Swan. They are the editors of All the Money in the World, How the Forbes 400 Make and Spend Their Fortunes. The book has been published to coincide with the 25th anniversary of the Forbes 400 list with the collaboration of Forbes magazine. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Between them, our guests Annalyn Swan and Peter Bernstein have worked as journalists and editors for 25 years. They've worked at the following publications, U.S. News and World Report, Time, Newsweek, and Fortune magazine, that between them. The book, All the Money in the World, is published by Knopf. And again, if you'd like to join our discussion, 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Annalyn, Peter, welcome. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Nice to be here.
Whose idea was the list?
Well, the list was the idea of Malcolm Forbes, who was then the publisher of Forbes magazine in 1982, but actually his grandfather had a similar idea in the 1920s when he published a similar, smaller list.
Now, why didn't that list catch on, and why 400?
Well, that's a good guess, but we would speculate that Malcolm Forbes had a fabulous idea for promotion at exactly the right moment in history, because if you look at the 25-year history of the list, you see a huge rise in entrepreneurship in this country, sort of a collective movement away from the corporate man, the corporate chieftain who was the hero of the 1950s, and then gradually what you see is the surfacing of all of this self-made money. And so Malcolm thought there was a great opportunity here to treat the rich as if they were the superstars of, say, sports or entertainment, just, you know, treating them in the same way.
Yeah.
And the list is a riff on Mrs. Astor,
yeah,
and her ballroom in the late 19th century. And the 400, of course, referred to the collection of socially prominent New York families who could fill that boardroom.
Yeah, fill the ballroom. How do the richest today compare to the richest of the era of Mrs. Astor?
Well, we did actually one of our favorite charts in the book looks at the all-time richest Americans with their dollars compared to the gross domestic product of their time. So the titans that we all think of as the great, you know, the biggest fortunes in history, American history, John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, Cornelius Vanderbilt, they absolutely swamp today's billionaires. John D. Rockefeller at his height was worth $305 billion in, you know, today's equivalent dollars, putting him the number one all-time richest. Andrew Carnegie following with $281.1 billion, and Gates at his richest was worth about $80 billion by comparison. So he's much farther down the all-time richest list.
Hmm. Now, 25 years ago, as I mentioned, you had to have $75 million to make the list. Today, you need to have more than a billion. What accounts for this rapid jump in wealth accumulation?
Well, One thing, of course, is just the inflation that accounts for the growth in numbers. But in the last 25 years, we've seen, you know, what some have called a second gilded age, or sort of a huge increase in wealth in America. And at the same time, you know, it's clearly that the rich are getting richer, and the rest of us are, you know, not progressing at that level. I mean, in 1982, the Forbes 400, the collective wealth of the Forbes 400 accounted for about 2% of the gross domestic product at that time. And now it's up to almost 10%. So 400 people are accounting for, you know, and their collective wealth is worth 10% of the GDP. That's a phenomenal increase.
Yeah. And if you want to sort of concretize it even more, the people at the very top of the list are making millions per day. Sheldon Adelson, for example, the casino impresario, makes something on the order of $22 to $23 million a day. So, you know, that's such a staggering figure to wrap your mind around.
Yeah, it is. Well, how do these people who are making all this money, I mean, how do they get their minds around it?
Well, one thing that I think is sort of at the root of the question you were asking is sort of how do they make their money, and that has changed dramatically as, you know, our economy has changed. In the early 80s, the largest segment of Forbes 400 fortunes came from oil, and that's switched so that today the largest segment comes from finance, about a quarter of the people on the list, even more if you factor in the last year, this year's list, 2007, where half of the of the 40-odd people who are new to the list were making their money in finance.
Yeah, and nearly half, according to the website, nearly half of the 45 new members made their fortunes in hedge funds.
That's correct. I think that's to the point of, you know, this sort of preposterous aspect of this huge money accumulation. You know, in the old days, oil came out of the ground and you could sort of understand how the fortune was made. Now with almost 25% of the list is the financiers who are, you know, engaging in computer-generated arbitrage and these sort of sophisticated trading systems that most people cannot understand, and the amount that they can make is just overwhelming. One of our favorite statistics is in 2006, James Simon, who's one of the leading hedge financiers, his salary was $1.8 billion for 1 year, and then we compared that to the big Wall Street banks, and the chairman and head of Goldman Sachs for the same year made $54 million. So $1.8 billion versus $54 million.
And of course, if you cast your mind back a century ago, you know, to the Cornelius Vanderbilt and Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller, I mean, their fortunes were based on steel, oil, and transportation. I mean, things that were really building America at the time. I mean, and these days, as we just discussed, it's really more finance. Technology, of course, has mm-hmm. also seen a huge increase over the last 25 years. You know, in 82, technology fortunes accounted for 2 or 3% of the 400. Now it's quadrupled up to around 12%, but it's still only half the number of fortunes that are made in finance these days.
Yeah, and Bill Gates still tops the list.
Bill Gates has topped the list consistently since 1994, and despite, you know, giving away all of his billions, he's still there, he's still reigning. But the funny thing about Bill Gates is he now has a contender for the worldwide richest man in the person of somebody named Carlos Slim Helú, who's a Mexican industrialist, who's very quickly closing in on Gates to be the number one in the world.
The Forbes 400, just we should tell your listeners, only includes Americans who are alive. Forbes magazine does publish another list of the world's richest, the billionaires list, it's called, that compares Americans' wealth to, you know, all the rest people around the world.
Yeah, well, how do the richest Americans compare to the richest people around the world?
Very favorably.
That's right. They're still doing very, very well. But the percentage of Americans on the list is dropping by a small percentages every year. Once upon a time, they completely dominated the list. Now about 44% of the world's richest people are Americans.
Hmm. Does membership in the 400 remain fairly constant, fairly consistent?
Well, that's another huge finding and surprising finding in our book in several ways, because there's been a tremendous fluidity in the wealth in America. We thought going in that you'd see the same names over and over again, and to a certain extent you do. But the average amount of time that a single individual spends on the list is about 7.5 years. And there have been roughly 1,350 people on the list over the last 26 years. So you can sort of see both change and constancy. The second point, though, is the huge shift towards self-made wealth. In 25 years ago, it was about 50-50. Half the members of the list were self-made millionaires then, and half had inherited their wealth. Now it's closer to two-thirds are self-made billionaires.
Mm. And how many are women?
Very, very few. That's one of the most startling findings. When you actually break down the list, you find that, for example, 97 immigrants have made the list. But over 25 years, only 12 working women have made the list. And the numbers have dropped astronomically. There were about 75 women on the list in 1982, when, of course, heiresses and inherited wealth was still a larger factor. By 2007, there are 39. So, of course, the interesting question becomes, obviously, the heiresses are going to be declining in number with all the other inherited money, but where are the self-made women as women go into the workforce and take over CEO jobs? We have Meg Whitman. We have Meg Whitman. I mean, there's so few that you can count them on one hand.
Mm. Oh, we have Martha Stewart and Oprah Winfrey.
To my point, you can count them on one hand. There are, I think, 13 working women over the course of the entire list, but some of those started with a silver spoon, so to speak, in their mouth. Catherine Graham, of course, of the Washington Post Company would be one great example. But Estee Lauder is among the handful who, you know, didn't inherit money. But it's a striking fact, and we did try to ask people, you know, just for their opinion, we asked the other Forbes 400 members, why did they think that women were not on the list? And they were extremely hesitant to answer. In fact, they didn't answer at all. This was a question that they didn't want to touch.
Of course, it's all the more puzzling given what's happened to women in the workplace in the last 25 years, where, you know, more and more women are A, working, and B, entering corporate America, so, and becoming entrepreneurs. So it's just a puzzling.
Why does that question make them uncomfortable?
Well, my private speculation is because of what happened to Larry Summers, the president of Harvard. If you recall, he got into terrible hot water and subsequently, lost his job or resigned because he said that women perhaps were not as genetically capable of doing math and science. And then there was a great outcry from women scientists who pointed out that that was absurd and that in the essential years for getting tenure in the science and math track would be the 30s. When one was in one's 30s, and of course women were often split between the mommy track and academe, and so it was a very heated outcry that came after him. So I think when we asked the Forbes 400 members, they thought, because I don't think anyone wanted to say, well, maybe women aren't as risk averse, or you know, maybe they don't want to take chances, or all of the things that a lot of the Forbes 400 members display. I mean, we did find that there are certain personality traits that a lot of them had in common, and one of those would be taking risks. But again, no one wanted to say, claim a theory about why women were not making the 400.
I think that's Annalyn's touched on something that we very much tried to do in the book. The book was meant to really look at great wealth in America over the last 25 years. And while we have lots of statistics and charts gathered from the list, it's really the main purpose of the book was really an inquiry into sort of the personality and character of the people who are on the list. For the whole first part is four or five chapters is on what it takes, mm-hmm. and we explore sort of attitudes towards risk-taking, the role of luck and timing, the role of education and intelligence. And, you know, if we sort of looked at this as an inquiry and what does it take to get rich in America, and it helps sort of people who read it, you know, are able to sort of tease those themes out in from it.
Yeah. Well, this we can kind of riff here a little bit on the idea of why people were uncomfortable about talking about why there aren't more women on the list. It's not particularly smart to do so. That's Annalyn's speculation, and it sort of seems to make pretty good sense to me. And this goes to, you know, the discussion of intelligence that is included in the book, in the first section of the book, what it takes. One of the things we find is a discussion of intelligence. What kind of intelligence leads to financial success?
Well, I think that the bottom line, you could say, no one really knows for sure. But the one thing that's absolutely clear is that a very, very high IQ is not the answer. I mean, there are several people on the list with legendarily high IQs, Bill Gates among them. But what you really find is a need for so-called successful IQ, emotional IQ. In other words, people who have actually studied highly successful personality types, they look at the range of factors that's required. It's just not raw intellect. And so basically your interpersonal skills comes into play here, things of that nature. Now, having said that, Peter and I always laugh because you will come up with something that sounds like a very interesting thesis, as in everybody in the 400 needs a sort of emotional IQ, the ability to interact with other people in order to get to the top, plus intelligence. And then you find examples of people on the fourth 400 who have absolutely no interpersonal skills to speak of, who are extremely abrasive. And one example that springs to mind, of course, is Larry Ellison. I mean, there are people on that list who have, run roughshod over people. And in fact, we have a whole chapter devoted called Winning is Everything, devoted to these sort of extreme examples of ruthlessly competitive people who yet are on the list.
Yeah. So winning is everything, you know, but, you know, being competitive is one thing, but, you know, that you could slip into greediness and you could go from strong-willed to tyrannical pretty easily as well. What is it like to work for these folks? Did you do any kind of investigation in that regard?
Well, as Annalyn says, I mean, we looked pretty hard at sort of what at that question, and you know, if it gets to some of them are pretty tough on to work for. You know, you take Walmart, which has gotten and Sam Walton was on the list in 1982 until he died in the early 90s, but they have a pretty well-deserved reputation for, you know, not giving their workers health care benefits, for keeping them a lot on part-time so that they don't have to pay full employee benefits. You know, Nike and Phil Knight, one of its founders, is a longtime 400 member. I mean, they got a lot of bad press for paying their workers, shifting work overseas into mainly Asia, where, you know, they paid workers less than a dollar a day. Larry Ellison, Bill Gates, you know, are ruthlessly competitive. I mean, they're really out to annihilate anybody in business who competes with them. And, you know, you see the remnants of that as recently as this week when Microsoft conceded in the antitrust case that they've been fighting for 9 years in Europe.
Yeah, and this idea of winning is everything can get you into a lot of trouble. One of the graphics in the book is about is titled "In Trouble with the Law." Folks have been convicted, gone to jail, some for crimes such as fraud, tax evasion, insider trading, and the like.
It's one interesting thing to us, though, is I think there's 13 people who have actually been tried and convicted in some way, and that's a quite small number if you actually think about it. So there clearly is for every Bernie Ebers and WorldCom, there's going to be, you know, 10 or 20 who either, you know, go close to breaking the law but don't go over, or are extremely adept at kind of getting their way out of trouble. It's a very small number, relatively speaking.
Hmm. Journalists and editors Annalyn Swan and Peter Bernstein are our guests in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. They are the co-editors of All the Money in the World, How the Forbes 400 Make and Spend Their Fortunes. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name's Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now calling in from Centralia. Line 4, hi.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking the call. Very interesting show. Just a couple of quick questions for your guests, and I'll ring off. I missed the first part, so I apologize ahead of time if you already covered this. A few years ago, I was involved in a hospital foundation, and the main claim that we always made was this great transference of wealth from one generation to the next, and that was supposed to cap out here in a few years. I was just wondering, is that curve already going down? Is that money, has that, for the most part, already been transferred? And was wondering, as far as the question is, what does it take to be on the 400? I work for a healthcare company. It was started 10 years ago by a lady in her 30s. She recently sold it for $7 million and has been able to retire in her 30s. But my take on it is basically filling a niche, filling a void, you know, being an opportunist, obviously very lucky, but I was wondering how much of that would come into play as far as what makes up the list. And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, just to the listener's first question about the transference of wealth from one generation to the next, I mean, it's a truism that fortunes are decrease over time, almost without exception. And, you know, we looked at old money fortunes, for example, the Rockefellers, the DuPonts, the Fords, the Hearsts, and in 1982, the Rockefellers, I think there were 42 Rockefellers on the list. Today, there are none. The DuPonts, there were a huge number of DuPonts on the list, I think somewhere in the 20s, and today there are none. But this doesn't mean that the DuPont family isn't still a very, very wealthy family. It is. It's just they're worth several billion dollars. It's just among 300 descendants or so of the originals who started the chemical company. So that transfer of wealth, I think, is a reality that's still going on and on.
Hmm. And should I just talk about the second part of the question?
Yeah.
Which is filling niches, because your caller is absolutely right. We spent or dedicated a chapter of the book to something we would call blue collar billionaires. And in that particular chapter, we looked at the number of fortunes that were made mostly in service industries and sort of nuts and bolts things, basically filling a niche, or as we say, building a better mousetrap. About 187 fortunes over the course of the 25 years are in this area. Candy, 99-cent stores, waste management, things of that sort, where the trick is often that there may indeed be an existing business, but you find a better way to do it. You find a way to automate your inventory. You find a better way to deal with your truckers. So that's exactly the point. Niche businesses, if you can do them better, are a wonderful way to make the Forbes 400 list.
Mm. You know, Wayne Huizenga, who made many, many fortunes, but his first fortune was in picking up garbage, waste management company. He bought garbage companies all across the country, put them together into a single entity. There's nothing new about that.
I think my favorite niche, or one of my favorite niche businesses, was Ty Warner of Beanie Babies. Which is he basically single-handedly created a niche. He was a salesman for plush, stuffed animals, and on a trip to Italy saw these little adorable, their version of these little adorable plush animals, so he came back to this country and not only created the line of Beanie Babies, but also by very carefully controlling inventory, he had a run on them, and so they became, limited edition, and he built himself a vast fortune on the back of plush little Beanie Babies.
Mm. Another one of our favorite examples is David Gold. He'd been in the retail business for a long, long time, but he basically reinvented the five and dime store, you know, Woolworths. He noticed that items that they sold for 99 cents moved a lot faster than items they sold for 98 cents or a dollar. And he created, you know, a fortune for himself and his family creating 99 cent stores.
Yeah, wow. What is it? The 59 second manager. Right?
60-second.
The 60-second, but then
the one-minute manager, I think.
The one-minute manager.
Your point, it should be 59, right.
Yeah, and then to go one better, from the one-minute manager to the 59th. What does luck have to do with it? That's also interesting.
Well, you know, what is very interesting to us is that, you know, in general, in the general population, people don't like to attribute their success primarily to luck. You know, you hear that again and again, and in fact, we cite in the book a study by Harvard sociologist Christopher Jenks, and he did a very controversial survey in the 1970s that basically said luck has a great deal to do with getting ahead in life. But what Peter and I found very interesting is when you talk to the Forbes 400 members themselves, they love the idea of luck. They endorse luck. They think it's wonderful. They love to cite to you the exact moments in their life when some great idea came to them or when, you know, luck turned their way or when they left one industry and went into another. So to them, there's nothing wrong or bad about luck. They embrace it.
One of our favorite quotes is from Ray Hunt, the son of wildcatting legend H.L. Hunt, who said, "Given the choice between luck and intelligence, always take luck."
And Ross Perot, he also had a couple of interesting things to say about luck and in how he, in his thinking, and is sure, you know, the way the ball bounces is gonna play a role.
It, that's true, and you know, he's been very lucky in business, not as lucky in politics.
Yeah. And another person in this chapter on luck is J.B. Hunt. Tell us a little bit about him, because we see those trucks on the road.
Oh, yeah. J.B. Hunt is, again, one of my favorite characters. I think my favorite characters all told mostly come from the Blue Collar Billionaires chapter, because there's one great story after another. But J.B. Hunt was a poor boy who grew up in, you know, as you know, Arkansas, and worked early on taking wood shavings from, I think it was his uncle's pulp mill, and he figured out a better way to have like a chicken coop device that would, you'd load the chips into there, the wood shavings, and then people could back up and load up their pickups and then take them off for chicken litter, for poultry litter. So that was his first bright idea in life. And he was sort of toying with that, and then he started driving trucks, also on a whim when somebody said that there were these trucks for sale and would he want to, you know, go for them. So he did, and he was driving around the back roads for 12 years, and he happened to see rice hulls sitting by the side of the road just abandoned, and everybody was just burning them, and he had the brilliant idea again of taking the rice hulls and using them for poultry litter. So simultaneously, he was creating two businesses which would each individually would have put him on the map. But the trucking one became even more important after he sold off the poultry litter business, and he came along at right when the interstate commerce, the laws were loosening about deregulation of the trucking industry, and he gambled, almost went broke twice, but gambled successfully, put all of his money in it, and of course his trucking company is one of the foremost ones in the country.
Hmm. Let's take another call now, a listener in Champaign County on line one. Hello.
Hi. Of course, the Hunt family are the ones that are getting the oil concessions in Kurdistan right now, which is a little bit like being born on third base, since their connections are probably why they have the audacity to try to go around the central government and general U.S. policy. But that's not really what I wanted to talk about, since you were talking about the Hunts. I'm wondering, you said there was a lot of volatility in the list, and I'm just wondering how much of that is this private equity and non-stockholder-related equity groups. Carlyle is one of the big ones, and I'm wondering how Danny Rubenstein, who's the sort of CEO of that, they're an interesting business because they rely on a lot of defense contracts, which I guess is old money. They seem to be trying to buy up one of the biggest nursing home, Manor Care, and which is kind of an odd place for a private equity people to be placing their bets. But then I guess there's a little baby boomer retirement and casualties of war to take care of through the years.
Well, just one point of clarification on the Hunts. J.B. Hunt, the trucking J.B. Hunt, is no relation to H.L. Hunt and the oil Hunts and Bunker and Nelson Hunt, just by the way. As for Carlyle Group and David Rubenstein, they've been hugely successful over the last 25 years. David Rubenstein just made the list for the first time this year, I think, with a fortune of somewhere, I'm not sure I'm remembering exactly right, but somewhere between $2 and $4 billion. And, you know, like Carlyle, like Blackstone, another private equity firm, and Apollo, they have made huge bets taking businesses private, basically, over the last decade and a half. Carlyle, as you rightly say, has concentrated often in defense-oriented businesses. And, you know, former President Bush has sat on their board. I think Brent Scowcroft has also sat on their board. Frank Carlucci, a former Secretary of Defense. And, you know, they have huge holdings in Europe. They've just gotten a huge investor from one of the Gulf states, and they've been enormously successful.
But the other point I wanted to make about private equity is that since they're being taxed at the 15% capital gains rate, that part of their accumulation of wealth is the fact that they're, as it's been notably said, paying less in taxes per share of their income than the help that cleans their offices.
Well, that's absolutely true, and I think that's why there is some degree of dislike and possibly even hostility in this country towards this sector. I think it's perceived as shadowy and entitled.
Yeah. In the book, there is a chapter on power and politics. What are the highlights in that chapter?
Well, one of the highlights, and then, Peter, you can take the rest, is one of the interesting facts, if you look at it, with all of this money that they can almost buy whatever they want in the world, most billionaires and Fortune 400 members have not been very successful when it comes to running for political office. There are a few exceptions. There are a couple Rockefellers, of course, governors of states, and then most notably right now, Michael Bloomberg, who mayor of New York City. But historically, the billionaires have not, it's not a good use of their money, in short, to run for office because their elected rate is pretty abysmal.
I mean, I think the other sort of big point that we make in that chapter is that it's really hard to pinpoint that our politics is being controlled by a sort of a plutocracy or of billionaires. I mean, sure, as companies, you know, they contribute to often both Republicans and Democrats, but they're really in terms of influencing public policy over the years or specific things, we found it very difficult to sort of say they have an inordinate amount of influence.
Mm. Probably a little footnote to that. Probably if you wanted to see where they've had the most influence, it would be on so-called think tanks. You know, George Soros most notably with his Open Society, which really did give huge amounts and influence policy in former Soviet.
And Richard Mellon Scaife, you know, the heir to the Mellon banking fortune, has been a huge backer of conservative causes, mainly the Heritage Foundation, which arguably has, you know, ever since the Reagan administration, has had a huge role in sort of influencing conservative thought in America.
But again, it's one remove, you know, or they may own newspapers. You know, of course, there's Rupert Murdoch that is sort of shining example number one, and the Fox Network, or Ted Turner with CNN before he divested himself of CNN. But the you don't see the influence at work directly. Maybe it's sort of indirectly there. They're funneling the money. They are influencing, but it's not as if they're getting elected to office.
You know, there are examples, and one of the leaders in advocating and arguing for campaign finance reform was a fellow named Jerry Kohlberg, one of the founders of Kohlberg, Kravis, and Roberts, another one of the buyout private equity firms. And yet, you know, he was, hugely influential, and he contributed his own money, set up a not-for-profit to lobby for campaign finance reform.
Mm. Let's take another call now, a listener in Chicago. Line 4. Hi.
Thank you. Regarding the influence of a plutocracy, as I understand it, when the Rockefeller was told that they had to break up in the monopoly they had with Standard Oil, and he said to break it up into different segments, he said, well, good, that's going to make that more legislatures that I can buy and put into office.
Comments?
Well, you know what, that I think in those days, the first Gilded Age, our politics were a lot, from what I've read in the history books about it, both about Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie and others, you know, there was much more corruption and influence buying than a century and a half later, you know, now.
Well, I think of Tammany Hall is another great example.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. At the close of the introduction to the book, you quote Andrew Carnegie, to die rich is to die disgraced. How do today's super rich feel about do they have any kind of a sense of responsibility for what this wealth and the responsibility that this wealth comes alongside?
Well, absolutely. There's a chapter in the book on philanthropy, and it's an interesting picture, I think, when you look at the whole thing. A lot of the very, very rich are enormously generous. I mean, Bill Gates gave $30 billion to set up the Gates Foundation. And like Carnegie and like Rockefeller before him, you know, they're developing huge amounts of their dedicating huge amounts of their fortune to good works, and that really continues today. I mean, education, our colleges and universities are largely funded by private contributions, and, you know, we have, I think it's all by generally acknowledged, the best higher education system in the world today. On the other side of the coin is that compared, the rich are not necessarily, if you, more generous than ordinary Americans. I mean, if you look at their capacity to give.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line 1.
Yeah, I have a question, but first a little comment. I would assume that Ayn Rand and her academic cousin Milton Friedman are rejoicing wherever they are with this development of so many billionaires. But you mentioned the political influence of these gentlemen on politics. Wasn't the Swift boat veteran ads and so forth funded by several Texas billionaires? And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
I don't know who funded this yeah. Swift boat. Do you, Peter?
Well, I think the listener is correct. I mean I don't think we mean to imply that the wealthy don't contribute money towards politics, and there are ways to even though there are now limits on how much you can contribute in direct contributions to any one candidates. There have been every election cycle. There seems to be a new wrinkle about ways that you can either contribute money to the party, or you can contribute to I forget the exact is it 501. And it's not 501c3, but there's another
reference to committees
to the tax code where you could contribute monies if they weren't directly, and that's what happened in Swift Boat. So there are ways to do it, and they, you know, I think there are good examples of where they have had an impact on our politics, but not in the ways that it was in Andrew Carnegie's day, for example.
Mm. And Celeste, it's interesting because you started this discussion by saying, you know, what prompts them to give. And we also looked at that. And, of course, even though John D. Rockefeller was ruthless and rapacious in his business dealings, you know, he also thought that he was motivated by a sort of God-given sense that you had to give back. You know, he was very much an upstanding Protestant. And while you see religion is still a factor in giving money away today, it's sort of less so, but there's a kind of sense of everything ranging from narcissism as a motivator to altruism to some of these people have an absolute passionate need to give away money to some cause that they think is really important. You see this very much in education and also in medical research. Often if you've been brushed with some you know, terminal illness or some had some verdict like that hanging over your head, you'll often be motivated to give away a great deal of money to medical research and to furthering, you know, Michael Milken cancer, to trying to stop other people from having this disease.
Mm. And one other thing I'd add, I'd say there is a mini trend among the Forbes 400 billionaires to sort of take the Andrew Carnegie pledge, which is to give all their money away before they die. I mean, one interesting example is a man named Charles Feeney, who started the duty-free stores that you find in airports all over the world. And his Atlantic Philanthropies, which he set up in great secrecy and established with about $3 to $4 billion, he's pledged to give that all away within the next 10 years. Mike Milken is another well-known Forbes 400 member who has said that by the time he dies, he's going to give all his money away. T. Boone Pickens, Sandy Weill, the former head of Citicorp, a South Dakota banking billionaire, Denny Sanford, has said the same thing.
Mm.
Whether they succeed and whether they actually do it is another question. But
yeah. There are a couple of questions that we have to ask, I think, before we wrap up. And the two remaining questions that I have that really stick out for me here and that I want to get in. Does success equal money? And are the Forbes 400 happy people?
Well, we thought that that was such a burning question and one that people would always ask us if we said that we were working on the book. We decided to ask the 400 members themselves. So we include in their afterword in the book, it says, does money equal happiness? And they acknowledged, all of them, some correlation. They were willing to go that far and say, yes, there was a correlation. But just how far the correlation went, people then diverged greatly. We had some wonderful quotes from people who with their ideas about money, and one of our favorites was T. Boone Pickens, who said, a happy person with money is probably happier, and an unhappy person with money is never happy. Money is not going to fix it. So there's a sense that, you know, if you're going in through life glass half full and you make your fortune, you're going to be one happy camper. On the other hand, if you're a glass half empty, and going through life, it ain't going to make it all that much rosier for you.
Let me take the first part of your question on whether success and money really go together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people who, a lot of the people, and this is a generalization, of course, list, are obsessive workaholics. And many of them that we interviewed, Kenneth Ford, a timber baron, for example, would say, you know, he loves, all he does is work, that his life is very, very one-dimensional. John Kluge, who built up a media empire, said, I hate the weekends. I look forward to Monday, you know. And, you know, not that there aren't many examples among the 400 of people who have widely many interests and pursue them, but these are, as a group, sort of very obsessive, very driven people, and whether, you know, they're enjoying happy family lives or rich cultural lives or emotional lives, you know, who's to tell? But mm-hmm. It's interesting, if you look over history, of course, and at the list of richest Americans over the past century, we've heard of some of them, but more often than not, a lot of them are forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, the two of you, for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Peter Bernstein and Annalyn Swan are the editors of All the Money in the World, How the Forbes 400 Make and Spend Their Fortunes. The book is published by Knopf.